question. So when we talk about adaptation, we mean allowing people or communities or places to better manage the risks of climate change or the impacts of climate change. So, for example, we are seeing greater heat waves across the world, more intense and more frequent. And adaptation is helping people respond to those. So that might be, for example, changing the working hours of the day so manual laborers don't have to be out in the middle of the day and burning heat. Or it might be supporting community spaces to provide cooling for people who can't afford it at home. Or it might be building flood defenses in places along the coast and are being threatened by storm surges. Or it might be putting in place early warning systems, for example, hurricanes, to help people move away as quickly as possible to find somewhere safe. So adaptation can mean many different things, depending on the types of hazards that people are facing and really how vulnerable they are. Because, you know, some people may already have the resources to manage something like extreme heat by themselves, but other people don't. And so adaptation is making sure that everyone has got the support and the capacity that they need to manage the changing climate which is coming our way.
You travelled and met with many groups in many countries, including India. Do you think there is more intense demand for adaptation in developing countries than in the West?
Adaptation has started out as an issue that was primarily framed around developing countries, those in the global south. And I think that's partly because there are often much higher levels of poverty in some of those countries, and they're also working in sectors that are more directly exposed to the climate. So, for example, smallholder farmers just don't have much resilience if there's a drought or a flood. So I think that has been the way the issue kind of was historically thought about. But what we're increasingly seeing is that adaptation is an issue for everybody. So, you know, we've seen hurricanes hitting multiple countries. We've seen the European floods. We've seen heat waves across multiple countries. So increasingly it's clear that adaptation is not something happening elsewhere. It's kind of happening everywhere. And almost every country that we can think of is going to need to adapt to the impacts of climate change.
Right. It's not just Bangladesh. It's downtown Los Angeles after those fires, for example. Now, in your book, Sink or Swim, you examine adaptation roles for institutions like the military and financial markets. What are the potential opportunities and risks of involving these powerful actors in shaping climate strategies?
Well, I think, you know, the military is a really interesting example because they're often a kind of a force that's available within a country. They've been used to respond for disasters, for wildfires, for flood management. And in some ways that makes sense because they're there and they're ready and they've often got the equipment that they need. But there are some really hard questions that this provokes. So, you know, one is, like, if we use the military in that way to respond day to day to the threats that we're facing within countries, what about if they needed for a wider defense? Will they still be ready? You know, are we taking away some of their capacity by doing these day-to-day activities? And the other is thinking about, well, actually, what is the role of the military within a country? And is it helpful, or do all countries want that, you know, the military to play that role? Because in some places, the military may be a benign force. In others, they may be particularly aligned with a political group, and they may marginalize others. And it's a very particular type of disaster risk management, which comes with the military, which is obviously just aligned with the way that they work. So I think whilst some of those new actors do kind of give us capacity and resource and ways of managing the threats, I think it's also really important to stop and think, what are the implications of using those types of actor? And I think the private sector and finance is another really interesting example, that increasingly adaptation is kind of interwoven with financial mechanisms of ways of kind of managing risk. And whilst that can really work in some scenarios, insurance has often really helped people, you know, manage their risk. In some cases, it also leaves people out, people who can't be insured, for example, or can't find a financial market for their risk. It risks not really always paying out. So I think there's some risk to what we call the financialization of adaptation, which is making it all about the money, because a lot of it is also about how people live their lives, their well-being, you know, their health and their educational outcomes, things that aren't necessarily captured when you only think about things from a financial perspective.
Among developed countries, are there any well-aimed adaptation projects or programs that stand out to you, Susanna?
Yeah, well, I think we do have some really great examples of countries managing existing climate variability that will hopefully become examples of also managing the future. So, you know, in London, where I live, we have something called the Thames Barrier, which is built to prevent flooding in central London. And it's been a big infrastructure investment. And it's also built to manage the future. So they review the research and the science every 5 to 10 years and see what they'll need to do to keep building that barrier up as we face sea level rise. And that's really a critical part of protecting London's infrastructure. Elsewhere, obviously the Netherlands have got a very long history of managing flooding and water issues and have really developed that into a national scale. So I think we do see these examples of where people and countries have taken the next step. And I think what we need to do is make sure that those positions are going to be suitable for the future, because often they were built for a past climate. And now we need to think about moving them and kind of updating them to face the ongoing risk.
And tell us about transformational adaptation. What is that?
So the idea here is, in many places, we might be able to keep going as we are, and so make small changes to the system, small changes to how we live our lives, and, you know, climate change won't affect us too much. And I would call that incremental change. So, you know, you might be able to just put on an extra jumper if it's colder, or you're fine in an extra slightly hotter temperature. It doesn't affect your life too much. But I think as we look at the way global temperatures are going, it's likely that that won't be enough in some places, that we'll actually have to make quite significant changes in how we live our lives, where we're living, where we consider to be safe. And I would call that transformational adaptation. So it's really a change in how people are living, a kind of step change away from business as usual to doing something quite different. And I think perhaps one of the easiest ways to think about that is thinking about what's been known as relocation, planned relocation. So communities who are living in low-lying coastal areas, we might think an incremental way to help them would be, for example, to, you know, give an early warning system if a flood is coming, or build a barrier. But in some of these places, that's just not going to be enough over time. And a transformational approach would be to work with them to find another place, essentially to relocate the whole community. And obviously, it's really, really hard to do those things, and people don't necessarily want to. It's hard to bear the short-term cost, and people, of course, are very attached to the places they call home. So these are very often difficult decisions to make, but they're some of the decisions that we might have to face up to as the global temperatures warm.
And experts also talk about hard and soft limits to adaptation. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that's thinking about the limit of adaptation is when you can no longer continue living as you are and you need to really do something differently. And a soft limit might be the limit that we don't at the moment have the technology, for example, to manage the changing temperatures or to grow crops in a particular area. But those limits might change over time. Or, for example, we don't have the resources to build a really large flood defense around a particular city. But that's a bit of a soft limit in that it may change over time in terms of the money that a country has or their willingness to pay for it as the floods increase. But a hard limit would be a really hard, firm limit, saying X land is going to go below sea level, or this could be really unlivable. And that's really a hard physical limit where we really can't push it any further.
There are all sorts of strange new problems coming up as the climate changes. For example, in the book, you ask, who has the right to moving fish? What is the issue, and is it happening already?
Yeah, so as the oceans warm, we see the patterns of some migratory fish move, as the fish want to get away from the hotter waters back to the climates that they're used to. So the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is anticipating that many of the fish will be moving away from the waters around the equator to cooler areas. And one of the things I discuss, particularly in the book, is this case in the Pacific, where they have very highly migratory species of tuna, and they have a very well-developed system for managing it. And they kind of share the catch between them, and it's highly worked out to make sure that it benefits the people living in the small islands around that area. And so one of the questions I'm posing is, as these fish start to move and they move out of these management regimes that have developed over time to support the people who live there, you know, what is a fair and just way of dealing with that? If we have countries who had a natural resource which has now moved on, you know, is there a way that we can make it fair in terms of how we continue to fish? Or do we just accept that as the fish move on, usually away from countries that haven't caused the problem, off towards those who have, that those countries also benefit? So I think this is a really hard choice in terms of how do we think about a just way of dealing with these changes.
Technically, loss and damage refers to impacts from climate change that cannot be prevented by adaptation. Are there international plans to provide help after climate-driven loss and damage?
Yeah, so loss and damage is now the third pillar of climate change policy. If we think we've got mitigation, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, adapting, kind of managing the impact, and then loss and damage, what's left after we can't adapt. So the international community has put in place a fund for responding to loss and damage, with the idea that that will start to fund countries, for example, after an extreme event, or to help them commemorate things or cultures or places or language that are lost. That is being developed, but as yet there's really not enough finance going into it. So as we see in the broader international system, there has been a desire to create that loss and damage fund, but at the moment we're not seeing the significant funds going into it that would meet the scale of the loss and damage that we expect to see.
And your book cites work by Siri Erickson and Lisa Schipper, finding some adaptation strategies actually make things worse. Tell us about maladaptation, and can you give us an example?
Yeah, so the idea of maladaptation is that whilst people or a donor agency or government might implement a project trying to help people manage the risk of climate change, in fact, in some situations, this can either make things worse for that particular community. If, for example, maybe the project didn't take into account longer-term climate trends, so it might, for example, support people to use a new irrigation technology in a particular area, but actually as water declines, irrigation isn't a feasible strategy anymore. So that would be maladaptation because people have not actually been helped to become more resilient. Or another form of maladaptation would be when, for example, you might help one community living on a coastline to manage erosion and flooding through kind of building up defences, and that might actually just shift the risk down the coast to the next community where the water will instead be diverted, perhaps with even greater power. So by making one community more resilient, you're actually making another one worse off. So it's quite difficult to manage this, but of course, in some ways, it's not new that policies or programmes have unintended consequences. So the important thing is really to think through these questions in advance. So what are the longer term risks? You know, how might we manage them? How will this project deliver over time? And also, how will managing this risk for this particular group of people in this place, how will that spill over to others who are facing similar situations? I mean, adaptation is not perfect, and that's kind of part of my book, to say that everyone is trying their best. But there are inevitable unintended consequences or things that we're learning because it was a new agenda, really. So we are learning how to adapt, and we need to learn quickly because the climate impacts are escalating quickly.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Susanna Fisher, author of the new book Sink or Swim, How the World Needs to Adapt to a Changing Climate. The strongest Atlantic hurricane ever to hit land just arrived on the western end of Jamaica, the less developed region there. And 20 years ago, another hurricane flooded the poorest part of New Orleans. Talk to us about vulnerable people with, as you say in the book, long histories of structural exclusion.
One of the realities of the way that climate risks are hitting people is they are, of course, hitting existing structures within society. So people who are already vulnerable just because of economic exclusion or long structural histories of colonialism or other factors are often more in harm's way. And this is the kind of history of vulnerability, and we see that playing out now across multiple locations. And of course, it really strengthens the argument around climate justice because people who are often at the forefront of experiencing these impacts are really not those who've caused it and those who've already experienced many other situations of inequality. So it's something we need to really work on and also suggest how adaptation is not just about addressing additional climate risk, but also thinking about how to manage those existing structural inequalities that make people be at risk in the first place.
We may have created events and conditions so damaging that there will be no restitution here or abroad. What if we've done more damage to nature than anyone can pay for? What do you think?
Well, I guess the question is more than we can pay for is an interesting way of framing it. I mean, the costs of adaptation are really high, and there's a massive gap in terms of the money that's needed and the money that's been provided internationally, but also the money that developed countries are putting into their own adaptation. We're only really putting in a fraction of what's needed. So there is a huge financial gap. But I think it's about money, but it's also about more than money. It's about the fact that we're even now still building in floodplains, for example. We are continuing to increase our own risk at the same time as we can see that the cost of managing the risk is getting higher and higher. So on the face of it, there's more than we can currently manage because we haven't put enough finance into it, but we're also continuing to conduct our economies in business as usual, which is ramping up our risk. So I think it's two sides of the coin, and we can seek more investment through a variety of strategies, but we also need to change how we're managing risk.
You say conflict does not necessarily lead to violence or war. Congressman John Lewis talked about good trouble. Is there good conflict?
Well, I think conflict can be a way of surfacing disagreement between people and between countries. And I think it's often important to have those issues worked through a negotiated process or through something that allows people or countries to feel heard. Because otherwise, it can really escalate. And if people don't feel that their views are included or countries don't have a voice in a multilateral process, for example, that can lead to resentment and all kinds of other consequences. So, yes, I think there can be cases when conflict can be almost a transformative force that allows people to develop new solutions together. But obviously, the key is to avoid it descending into violence and war, which is what we do see in some circumstances.
As a global problem, climate action needs cooperation of all people and countries. But as we speak, and as you mentioned in the book, armed conflicts continue in many parts of the world. Do we have to wait for world peace, or can we start eliminating adaptation and getting it going despite war?
Yeah, I think this is a really tricky issue and one that many working on adaptation have struggled with, because many of the most climate vulnerable places in the world are also what might be called fragile and conflict-afflicted states. But the people living in those places are really vulnerable to climate change. But until now, donors and multilateral organizations have struggled with how to get money to those places when the governments and the institutions are so fragile. And I'm quite pragmatic on this, and I think we can't wait for perfect conditions because we're not going to get there. And so we need to think about how to get money into these places. And there have been, you know, some good examples of targeting individuals, for example, through cash payments or working through unusual actors in these spaces like faith-based groups. So I think there are ways to work around it. And I think, you know, as you say, we have to give up the idea of there being a perfect scenario. We have to do adaptation in the places that need it now.
And into this mix of wildly different human societies, now with a massive common problem, we toss in early-stage artificial intelligence. So how does AI change the story, or does it?
I mean, I think AI is one of many trends that are slightly shaping the world right now. And obviously, one of the key concerns has been about data usage and then kind of increasing energy supplies. But I think from the context of adaptation, for me, it's still the core issues that there are the changing trends in the world, and maybe that technology will help us in the future. But right now, I think we're still facing those same old issues of how to manage the climate impacts.
America's climate policy is whatever the president posts today. Canada makes lots of green promises and then builds even more fossil fuel production. What if there are really no policymakers? Maybe it's just the rest of us. What then?
I think we have to look to people who are leading the way, and they might not always be the politicians or the policymakers that we expect. And I think that we do see, you know, some countries leading the way on the energy transition, and we also see individuals taking the stance to make change that's needed. But you're right that we often see either countries or governments, you know, saying that they support climate action but still subsidizing fossil fuels, or in the case of some right now, just really not committing to the multilateral process at all. And I think in those situations, as I said, we've got to look for where we can find leadership and build behind those people and places, because we're at such a critical moment in history right now that we can't wait to get everybody back on board. We have to look for who's moving fast and go with them and try and build a coalition that can take the climate action that we need.
With your new book out, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still working on my academic work, which looks at how we finance some of these adaptation projects. And I'm also thinking about my next steps. So I'm particularly interested in what adaptation means in the UK right now. So the book I've just published is really a global picture, posing really big questions that face us globally. And now I'm really interested in taking those questions down, you know, to one particular place and thinking, like, what does this really mean for a set of communities living in this location?
We have been speaking with Susanna Fisher, Principal Research Fellow at University College London. Her new book is Sink or Swim, How the World Needs to Adapt to a Changing Climate. You can get more info and links to follow up in my weekly blog at ecoshock.org. Susanna, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Susanna Fisher's new book contends that adaptation is inseparable from climate justice and should be undertaken with communities rather than imposed upon them. In many Western minds, this raises the images of villages far away organizing themselves. Actually, this means you. We need to rein in consumption, starting with wealthy people who don't want to give up much, if anything. I think the majority of us are going to need to impose climate and justice on the 0.5% on the top of the fossil tower of power. Frankly, well-informed people think we are already heading into climate disaster. At some point, we may spend less time on planning for emission cuts in 2060 or minor cuts to help people feel they are contributing, and spend everything we've got on saving lives and livelihoods. As the title of Susanna's book suggests, it is adaptation or massive human failure, along with a cohort of other species of all size going down with us. Doomers would welcome a book that doesn't try to explain greenhouse gas reduction strategies. Again, many books and reports do this, thankfully. But an experienced voice talking about what will we do in this fast-developing new reality. This also goes to government and trust in government, doesn't it? Suppose scientists, financial experts, and government experts all agree 1 million people need to move away from their homes perched on the eastern seaboard because of extreme storms, storm surge, and rising seas. The current approach is to leave it up to homeowners, although there have been some buyout programs after major disasters, like hurricanes. For example, the U.S. FEMA has programs like the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program, or flood mitigation assistance. The structures purchased by the government are then demolished, and the land is rezoned as permanent open space. This is a key part of the process. The land cannot be rebuilt upon. It often converts into wetlands, dunes, or parkland to act as a natural buffer against future storms. Does FEMA still offer buyout money? Or was that slashed because of the climate hoax? One government response is to abandon people who made the mistake of building too close to a changing sea. After all, why should the rest of us pay for some millionaire who wanted front row seats to the ocean? And then they likely tried to wall that off so we can't get to the sea. It's not a good use of taxpayer money. Maybe instead governments should enforce warning labels and advertise risks. Every deed for an oceanfront property should show the risk right on it and clearly, and then the buyer has to sign it. There should be no liability for the taxpayer. In addition, as with cigarettes, government advertising could warn against building or moving into high-risk areas, whether it's closer to the sea or into fire-ready forests. All this, of course, may not work so well in Mumbai, where people must live where they must live. Susanna Fisher warns social tweaking is just not enough now. She writes, quote, Lee Barung Ford, a professor at the University of Leeds, noticed a few years ago that the global community had very little idea how adaptation to climate change was happening across the world. She brought together a team to analyze huge amounts of peer-reviewed research on adaptation. and the work published in the leading journal Nature Climate Change confirmed that adaptation so far has been small scale. It has focused on tweaking current policies and programs and has been uneven across the world, end quote. Fisher cites that paper, a systematic global stock take of evidence on human adaptation to climate change, published October 28, 2021, in the journal Nature Climate Change. Sometimes I wonder, am I just a climate justice doomer? Think of this. Almost all governments of developed countries already carry fantastic national debts that can never be repaid. Increasing chunks of tax dollars just go to treasury investors to pay off the debt. What if nations claim there is not enough money or resources to help every climate victim? Perhaps during a recession or economic crash in the West, there will be nothing to cover the cost of moving and resettling faraway strangers. A realist citing current trends might argue, despite conferences and pledges, it is obvious that a large part of humanity will move or die without the help from developed countries. And in fact, climate refugees may be resisted by force if they try to come, by the very countries who made the most out of burning fossil fuels. Are we just kidding ourselves about adaptation planning and international funds for climate damages? The largest single international funder of aid, America, just canceled all that. Not just internationally. The Trump administration has gutted FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. FEMA responded to disasters like hurricanes and flooding. And those are getting too large for a single state to pay for the recovery. Municipal budgets are already overloaded. Insurance companies are withdrawing from coverage or charging huge rates to discourage anyone but wealthy clients. That leaves it all to individuals, families, and local communities. That is where help in coming times will come from. All that needs to be fed and watered in advance. Get good with your family and community. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Strip off night.
Pretend away, that's right.
No need to ever look in the dark. Add a little green. Put it on a screen, green screen. Don't need daylight, don't need a light. No love at all among the stars. Out here in the dark. Dark, no color at all in the dark.
Dark.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. In spring and summer, yellow warblers sing from treetops in city parks and streamsides from Mexico to Canada. These lemon yellow birds especially love willow trees near running water, perfect for building a nest and finding food. Males have red streaks on their breasts. In some areas of the Caribbean and Central America, the males may also have chestnut-colored hoods or caps. Females are a shade paler yellow and have unstreaked breasts. The sexes split up nesting duties. The female incubates the eggs, while the male brings food for his mate and chicks. Though common, yellow warblers face imminent challenges. Over time, yellow warbler populations have adapted genetically to their local climates. That makes them vulnerable to environmental shifts, which could cause the species to lose much of its breeding range in the U.S. by 2080. Yellow warbler chicks are at risk during spring heat waves, and wildfires can destroy trees along stream banks. So addressing climate change means creating a more sustainable future for ourselves, but also keeping our most familiar and beloved birds around too. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
A special thank you to artist Heidi Stavrevsky for designing our 20th anniversary logo, which beautifully captures two decades of BirdNote storytelling. See the design at birdnote.org.